All he could say was, "How was I to know it was the Tiger Woman?" The time came when he would be proud of the encounter. She moved so fast, I didn't see exactly what she did or what happened. One moment I was going to shoot her down. I was sure she was some sort of madwoman, and the next thing I knew, I was completely overwhelmed. Doris held the guardsman in a firm grip, the hand with the blaster forced high. She said, "Either drop the blaster at once, or I will break your arm." The guardsman felt a kind of death grip around his chest that all but prevented him from breathing. Realizing he had no choice, he dropped the blaster. Doris Venebile released him. But before the guardsman could make a move to recover, he found himself facing his own blaster in Doris' hand. Doris said, "I hope you've left your detectors in place. Don't try to report what's happened too quickly. You had better wait and decide what it is you plan to tell your superiors. The fact that an unarmed woman took your blaster and your car may well put an end to your usefulness to the junta." Doris started the car and began to speed down the central roadway. A 10-year stay on the grounds told her exactly where she was going. The car she was in, an official ground car, was not an alien intrusion into the grounds and would not be picked up as a matter of course. However, she had to take a chance on speed, for she wanted to reach her destination rapidly. She pushed the car to a speed of 200 kilometers per hour. The speed, at least, eventually did attract attention. She ignored radioed cries, demanding to know why she was speeding, and before long the car's detectors told her that another ground car was in hot pursuit. She knew that there would be a warning sent up ahead, and that there would be other ground cars waiting for her to arrive. But there was little any of them could do short of trying to blast her out of existence, something apparently no one was willing to try, pending further investigation. When she reached the building she had been heading for, two ground cars were waiting for her. She climbed serenely out of her own car and walked toward the entrance. Two men at once stood in her way, obviously astonished that the driver of the speeding car was not a guardsman, but a woman dressed in civilian clothes. "What are you doing here? What was the rush?" Doris said quietly, "Important message for Colonel Hender Lynn." "Is that so?" said the guardsman harshly. There were now four men between her and the entrance. "Reference number, please." Doris said, "Don't delay me." "Reference number," I said. "You're wasting my time." One of the guardsmen said suddenly, "You know who she looks like? The old First Minister's wife, Dr. Venebile, the Tiger Woman." There was an odd backward step on the part of all four, but one of them said, "You're under arrest." "Am I?" said Doris. "If I'm the Tiger Woman, you must know that I am considerably stronger than any of you, and that my reflexes are considerably faster. Let me suggest that all four of you accompany me quietly inside, and we'll see what Colonel Lynn has to say." "You're under arrest," came the repetition, and four blasters were aimed at Doris. "Well," said Doris, "if you insist." She moved rapidly, and two of the guardsmen were suddenly on the ground groaning, while Doris was standing with a blaster in each hand. She said, "I have tried not to hurt them, but it is quite possible that I have broken their wrists. That leaves two of you, and I can shoot faster than you can. If either of you makes the slightest move, the slightest, I will have to break the habit of a lifetime and kill you. It will sicken me to do so, and I beg you not to force me into it." There was absolute silence from the two guardsmen still standing. No motion. "I would suggest," said Doors, "that you two escort me into the Colonel's presence, and that you then seek medical help for your comrades." The suggestion was not necessary. Colonel Lynn emerged from his office. "What is going on here? What is..." Doris turned to him. "Ah, let me introduce myself. I am Dr. Doris Van Abbeley, the wife of Professor Harry Selden. I have come to see you on important business. These four tried to stop me, and as a result, two are badly hurt. Send them all about their business and let me talk to you. I mean you no harm." Lynn stared at the four guardsmen, then at Doors. He said calmly, "You mean me no harm? Though four guardsmen have not succeeded in stopping you, I have 4,000 at my instant call." "Then call them," said Doors. "However quickly they come, it will not be in time to save you, should I decide to kill you. Dismiss your guardsmen, and let us talk civilly." Lynn dismissed the guardsmen and said, "Well, come in, and we will talk. Let me warn you, though, Dr. Van Abbeley, I have a long memory." "And I," said Doors. They walked into Lynn's quarters together. Chapter 15. Lynn said with utmost courtesy, "Tell me exactly why you are here, Dr. Van Abbeley." Doris smiled without menace, and yet not exactly pleasantly either. "To begin with," she said, "I have come here to show you that I can come here."
"Ah?"
"Yes. My husband was taken to his interview with the general in an official ground car under armed guard. I myself left the hotel at about the same time he did, on foot and unarmed. And here I am. And I believe I got here before he did. I had to wade through 5 guardsmen, including the guardsman whose car I appropriated, in order to reach you. I would have waded through 50. Lynn nodded his head phlegmatically. "I understand that you are sometimes called the Tiger Woman."
"I have been called that. Now, having reached you, my task is to make certain that no harm comes to my husband. He is venturing into the general's lair, if I can be dramatic about it, and I want him to emerge unharmed and unthreatened."
"As far as I am concerned, I know that no harm will come to your husband as a result of this meeting. But if you are concerned, why do you come to me? Why didn't you go directly to the general?"
"Because of the two of you, it is you that has the brains."
There was a short pause, and Lynn said, "That would be a most dangerous remark, if overheard."
"More dangerous for you than for me, so make sure it is not overheard. Now, if it occurs to you that I am to be simply soothed and put off, and that if my husband is imprisoned or marked for execution, that there will really be nothing I can do about it, disabuse yourself."
She indicated the two blasters that lay on the table before her.
"I entered the grounds with nothing. I arrived in your immediate vicinity with 2 blasters. If I had no blasters, I might have had knives, with which I am an expert. And if I had neither blasters nor knives, I would still be a formidable person. This table we're sitting at is metal, obviously, and sturdy."
"It is." Doris held up her hands, fingers splayed, as if to show that she held no weapon. Then she dropped them to the table, and palms down caressed its surface.
Abruptly, Doris raised her fist and then brought it down on the table with a loud crash, which sounded almost as if metal were striking metal. She smiled and lifted her hand.
"No bruise," Doris said. "No pain. But you'll notice that the table is slightly bent where I struck it. If that same blow had come down with the same force on a person's head, the skull would have exploded. I have never done such a thing. In fact, I have never killed anyone, though I have injured several. Nevertheless, if Professor Selden is harmed..."
"You are still threatening."
"I am promising. I will do nothing if Professor Selden is unharmed. Otherwise, Colonel Lynn, I will be forced to maim or kill you. And, I promise you again, I will do the same to General Tenar."
Lynn said, "You cannot withstand an entire army, no matter how tigerish a woman you are. What then?"
"Stories spread," said Doris, "and are exaggerated. I have not really done much in the way of tigerishness, but many more stories are told of me than are true. Your guardsmen fell back when they recognized me, and they themselves will spread the story, with advantage, of how I made my way to you. Even an army might hesitate to attack me, Colonel Lynn. But even if they did, and even if they destroyed me, beware the indignation of the people. The junta is maintaining order, but it is doing so only barely, and you don't want anything to upset matters. Think then of how easy the alternative is. Simply do not harm Professor Harry Selden."
"We have no intention of harming him."
"Why the interview, then?"
"What's the mystery? The general is curious about psychohistory. The government records are open to us. The old Emperor Cleon was interested. Demerzel, when he was first minister, was interested. Why should we not be in our turn? In fact, more so."
"Why more so?"
"Because time has passed. As I understand it, psychohistory began as a thought in Professor Selden's mind. He has been working on it, with increasing vigor and with larger and larger groups of people, for nearly 30 years. He has done so almost entirely with government support, so that, in a way, his discoveries and techniques belong to the government. We intend to ask him about psychohistory, which by now must be far advanced beyond what existed in the times of Demerzel and Cleon, and we expect him to tell us what we want to know. We want something more practical than the vision of equations curling their way through air. Do you understand me?"
"Yes," said Doris, frowning.
"And one more thing. Do not suppose that the danger to your husband comes from the government only, and that any harm that reaches him will mean that you must attack us at once. I would suggest that Professor Selden may have purely private enemies. I have no knowledge of such things, but surely it is possible."
"I shall keep that in mind. Right now, I want to have you arrange that I join my husband during his interview with the general. I want to know beyond doubt that he is safe."
"That will be hard to arrange and will take some time. It would be impossible to interrupt the conversation, but if you wait till it is ended..."
"Take the time and arrange it. Do not count on double-crossing me and remaining alive."
Chapter 16 General Tenar stared at Harry Selden in a rather pop-eyed manner, and his fingers tapped lightly at the desk where he sat.
30 years, he said. 30 years, and you are telling me you still have nothing to show for it?"
"Actually, General, 28 years.
Tenar ignored that. And all at government expense. Do you know how many billions of credits have been invested in your project, Professor?
I haven't kept up, General, but we have records that could give me the answer to your question in seconds.
And so have we. The government, Professor, is not an endless source of funds. These are not the old times. We don't have Cleon's old free and easy attitude toward finances. Raising taxes is hard, and we need credits for many things. I have called you here, hoping that you can benefit us in some way with your psychohistory. If you cannot, then I must tell you, quite frankly, that we will have to shut off the faucet. If you can continue your research without government funding, do so. For unless you show me something that would make the expense worth it, you will have to do just that.
General, you make a demand I cannot meet. But if in response you end government support, you will be throwing away the future. Give me time, and eventually...
Various governments have heard that eventually from you for decades. Isn't it true, Professor, that you say your psychohistory predicts that the junta is unstable, that my rule is unstable, that in a short time it will collapse?
Selden frowned. The technique is not yet firm enough for me to say that this is something that psychohistory states.
I put it to you that psychohistory does state it, and that this is common knowledge within your project.
No, said Selden warmly, no such thing. It is possible that some among us have interpreted some relationships to indicate that the junta may be an unstable form of government, but there are other relationships that may easily be interpreted to show it is stable. That is the reason why we must continue our work. At the present moment, it is all too easy to use incomplete data and imperfect reasoning to reach any conclusion we wish.
But if you decide to present the conclusion that the government is unstable and say that psychohistory warrants it, even if it does not actually do so, will it not add to the instability?
It may very well do that, General. And if we announce that the government is stable, it may well add to the stability. I have had this very same discussion with Emperor Cleon on a number of occasions. It is possible to use psychohistory as a tool to manipulate the emotions of the people and achieve short-term effects. In the long run, however, the predictions are quite likely to prove incomplete or downright erroneous, and psychohistory will lose all its credibility, and it will be as though it had never existed.
Enough. Tell me straight out. What do you think psychohistory shows about my government?
It shows, we think, that there are elements of instability in it. But we are not certain, and cannot be certain, exactly in what way this can be made worse or made better.
In other words, psychohistory simply tells you what you would know without psychohistory, and it is that in which government has invested uncounted piles of credits.
The time will come when psychohistory will tell us what we could not know without it, and then the investment will pay itself back many, many times over.
And how long will it be before that time comes?
Not too long, I hope. We have been making rather gratifying progress in the last few years. Tenar was tapping his fingernail on the desk again.
Not enough. Tell me something helpful now. Something useful.
Selden pondered, then said, I can prepare a detailed report for you, but it will take time.
Of course it will. Days, months, years, and somehow it will never be written. Do you take me for a fool?
No, of course not, General. However, I don't want to be taken for a fool either. I can tell you something that I will take sole responsibility for. I have seen it in my psychohistorical research, but I may have misinterpreted what I saw. However, since you insist...
I insist.
You mentioned taxes a little while ago. You said raising taxes was difficult. Certainly, it is always difficult. Every government must do its work by collecting wealth in one form or another. The only two ways in which such credits can be obtained are first, by robbing a neighbor, or second, persuading a government's own citizens to grant the credits willingly and peaceably. Since we have established a galactic empire that has been conducting its business in reasonable fashion for thousands of years, there is no possibility of robbing a neighbor, except as the result of an occasional rebellion and its repression. This does not happen often enough to support a government. And if it did, the government would be too unstable to last long in any case. Selden drew a deep breath and went on. Therefore, credits must be raised by asking the citizens to hand over part of their wealth for government use. Presumably, since the government will then work efficiently, the citizens can better spend their credits in this way than to hoard it, each man to himself, while living in a dangerous and chaotic anarchy. However, though the request is reasonable and the citizenry is better off paying taxes as their price for maintaining a stable and efficient government, they are nevertheless reluctant to do so. In order to overcome this reluctance, governments must make it appear that they are not taking too many credits and that they are considering each citizen's rights and benefits. In other words, they must lower the percentage taken out of low incomes. They must allow deductions of various kinds to be made before the tax is assessed, and so on. As time goes on, the tax situation inevitably grows more and more complex, as different worlds, different sectors within each world, and different economic divisions all demand and require special treatment. The result is that the tax-collecting branch of the government grows in size and complexity, and tends to become uncontrollable. The average citizen cannot understand why or how much he is being taxed, what he can get away with and what he can't. The government and the tax agency itself are often in the dark as well. What's more, an ever larger fraction of the funds collected must be put into running the over-elaborate tax agency, maintaining records, pursuing tax delinquents. So the amount of credits available for good and useful purposes declines, despite anything we can do. In the end, the tax situation becomes overwhelming. It inspires discontent and rebellion. The history books tend to ascribe these things to greedy businessmen, to corrupt politicians, to brutal warriors, to ambitious viceroys. But these are just the individuals who take advantage of the tax overgrowth. The general said harshly,
"Are you telling me that our tax system is overcomplicated?"
Selden said, "If it were not, it would be the only one in history that wasn't, as far as I know. If there is one thing that psychohistory tells me is inevitable, it is tax overgrowth."
"And what do we do about it?"
"That I cannot tell you. It is that for which I would like to prepare a report that, as you say, may take a while to get ready."
"Never mind the report. The tax system is overcomplicated, isn't it? Isn't that what you're saying?"
"It is possible that it is," said Selden cautiously.
"And to correct that, one must make the tax system simpler. As simple as possible, in fact."
"I would have to study."
"Nonsense. The opposite of great complication is great simplicity. I don't need a report to tell me that."
"As you say, General," said Selden.
At this point, the general looked up suddenly, as though he had been called, as indeed he had been. His fists clenched, and holovision images of Colonel Lynn and Doris Venevoli suddenly appeared in the room. Thunderstruck, Selden exclaimed, "Doris, what are you doing here?" The general said nothing, but his brow furrowed into a frown. Chapter 17. The general had had a bad night, and so, out of apprehension, had the colonel. They faced each other now, each at a loss. The general said, "Tell me again what this woman did." Lynn seemed to have a heavy weight on his shoulders. "She's the Tiger Woman, that's what they call her. She doesn't seem to be quite human somehow. She's some sort of impossibly trained athlete, full of self-confidence. And, General, she's quite frightening." "Did she frighten you, a single woman?" "Let me tell you exactly what she did, and let me tell you a few other things about her. I don't know how true all the stories about her are, but what happened yesterday evening is true enough." He told the story again, and the general listened, puffing out his cheeks.
"Bad," he said. "What do we do?"
"I think our course is plain before us. We want psychohistory."
"Yes, we do," said the general. "Selden told me something about taxation that... But never mind. That is beside the point at the moment. Go on."
Lynn, who in his troubled state of mind had allowed a small fragment of impatience to show on his face, continued. "As I say, we want psychohistory without Selden. He is, in any case, a used-up man. The more I study him, the more I see an elderly scholar who is living on his past deeds. He has had nearly 30 years to make a success of psychohistory, and he has failed. Without him, with new men at the helm, psychohistory may advance more rapidly."
"Yes, I agree. Now, what about the woman?"
"Well, there you are. We haven't taken her into consideration because she has been careful to remain in the background. But I strongly suspect now that it will be difficult, perhaps impossible, to remove Selden quietly and without implicating the government as long as the woman remains alive."
"Do you really believe that she will mangle you and me if she thinks we have harmed her man?"
said the general, his mouth twisting in contempt. "I really think she will, and that she will start a rebellion as well. It will be exactly as she promised."
"You are turning into a coward."
"General, please, I am trying to be sensible. I'm not backing off. We must take care of this Tiger Woman." He paused thoughtfully. "As a matter of fact, my sources have told me this, and I admit to having paid far too little attention to the matter."
"And how do you think we can get rid of her?"
Lynn said. "I don't know." Then, more slowly, "But someone else might." Chapter 18. Selden had had a bad night also, nor was the new day promising to be much better. There weren't too many times when Harry felt annoyed with Doris, but this time he was very annoyed. He said, "What a foolish thing to do. Wasn't it enough that we were all staying at the Dome's Edge Hotel? That alone would have been sufficient to drive a paranoid ruler into thoughts of some sort of conspiracy." "How? We were unarmed, Harry. It was a holiday affair, the final touch of your birthday celebration.
We posed no threat.
Yes, but then you carried out your invasion of the palace grounds. It was unforgivable. You raced to the palace to interfere with my session with the general when I had specifically, and several times, made it plain that I didn't want you there. I had my own plans, you know.
Doris said, Your desires and your orders and your plans all take second place to your safety. I was primarily concerned about that.
I was in no danger.
That is not something I can carelessly assume. There have been two attempts on your life. What makes you think there won't be a third?
The two attempts were made when I was First Minister. I was probably worth killing then. Who would want to kill an elderly mathematician?
Doris said, That's exactly what I want to find out, and that's what I want to stop. I must begin by doing some questioning right here at the project.
No, you will simply be upsetting my people. Leave them alone.
That's exactly what I can't do, Harry. My job is to protect you, and for 28 years I've been working at that. You cannot stop me now.
Something in the blaze of her eyes made it quite clear that whatever Selden's desires or orders might be, Doris intended to do as she pleased. Selden's safety came first.
Chapter 19
May I interrupt you, Hugo?
Of course, Doris, said Hugo Amaril with a large smile. You are never an interruption. What can I do for you?
I am trying to find out a few things, Hugo, and I wonder if you would humor me in this.
If I can.
You have something in the project called the Prime Radiant. I hear of it now and then. Harry speaks of it, so I imagine I know what it looks like when it's activated, but I have never actually seen it in operation. I would like to.
Emeril looked uncomfortable. Actually, the Prime Radiant is just about the most closely guarded part of the project, and you aren't on the list of members who have access.
I know that. But we've known each other for 28 years.
And you're Harry's wife. I suppose we can stretch a point. We only have 2 full Prime Radiants. There's one in Harry's office, and one here. Right there, in fact.
Doris looked at the squat black cube on the central desk. It looked utterly undistinguished.
Is that it?
That's it. It stores the equations that describe the future.
How do you get at those equations?
Emeril moved a contact, and at once the room darkened, and then came to life in a variegated glow. All around Doris were symbols, arrows, lines, mathematical signs of one sort or another. They seemed to be moving, spiraling. But when she focused her eyes on any particular portion, it seemed to be standing still.
She said, Is that the future, then?
It may be, said Amaril, turning off the instrument. I had it at full expansion so you could see the symbols. Without expansion, nothing is visible but patterns of light and dark.
And by studying those equations, you are able to judge what the future holds in store for us?
In theory. The room was now back to its mundane appearance. But there are 2 difficulties.
Oh, what are they?
To begin with, no human mind has created those equations directly. We have merely spent decades programming more powerful computers, and they have devised and stored the equations. But of course we don't know if they are valid and have meaning. It depends entirely on how valid and meaningful the programming is in the first place.
They could be all wrong, then?
They could be. Emeril rubbed his eyes, and Doris could not help thinking how old and tired he seemed to have grown in the last couple of years. He was younger than Harry by nearly a dozen years, but he seemed much older.
Of course, Emeril went on in a rather weary voice, we hope that they aren't all wrong. But that's where the second difficulty comes in. Although Harry and I have been testing and modifying them for decades, we can never be sure what the equations mean. The computer has constructed them, so it is to be presumed they must mean something. But what? There are portions that we think we have worked out. In fact, right now, I'm working on what we call Section A23, a particularly knotty system of relationships. We have not yet been able to match it with anything in the real universe. Still, each year sees us further advanced, and I look forward confidently to the establishment of psychohistory as a legitimate and useful technique for dealing with the future.
How many people have access to these prime radiants?
Every mathematician in the project has access, but not at will. There have to be applications and time allotted, and the prime radiant has to be adjusted to the portion of the equations a mathematician wishes to refer to. It gets a little complicated when everyone wants to use the prime radiant at the same time. Right now, things are slow, possibly because we're still in the aftermath of Harry's birthday celebration.
Is there any plan for constructing additional prime radiants?
Emeril thrust out his lips. Yes and no. It would be very helpful if we had a third, but someone would have to be in charge of it. It can't just be a community possession. I have suggested to Harry that Tamwile Elar, you know him, I think.
Yes, I do.
That Elar have a third prime radiant. His achaotic equations and the electroclarifier he thought up make him clearly the third man in the project after Harry and myself. Harry hesitates, however.
Why, do you know?
If Elar gets one, he is openly recognized as the third man, over the head of other mathematicians who are older and who have more senior status in the project. There might be some political difficulty, so to speak. I think that we can't waste time in worrying about internal politics, but Harry, well, you know Harry.
Yes, I know Harry. Suppose I tell you that Lynn has seen the Prime Radiant.
Lynn?
Colonel Hender Lynn of the Junta, Tenar's lackey.
I doubt that very much, Doors.
He has spoken of spiraling equations, and I have just seen them produced by the Prime Radiant. I can't help but think he's been here and seen it working.
Emeril shook his head. I can't imagine anyone bringing a member of the Junta into Harry's office, or mine.
Tell me, who in the project do you think is capable of working with the Junta in this fashion?
No one, said Emeril flatly, and with clearly unlimited faith. That would be unthinkable. Perhaps Lynn never saw the Prime Radiant, but was merely told about it.
Who would tell him about it?
Emeril thought a moment and said, No one.
Well now, you talked about internal politics a while ago in connection with the possibility of Elar having a third prime radiant. I suppose in a project such as this one, with hundreds of people, there are little feuds going on all the time. Frictions, quarrels.
Oh yes, poor Harry talks to me about it every once in a while. He has to deal with them in one way or another, and I can well imagine what a headache it must be for him.
Are these feuds so bad that they interfere with the working of the project?
Not seriously.
Are there any people who are more quarrelsome than others, or any who draw more resentment than others? In short, are there people you can get rid of and perhaps remove 90% of the friction at the cost of 5 or 6% of the personnel?
Amaryl raised his eyebrows. It sounds like a good idea, but I don't know whom to get rid of. I don't really participate in all the minutiae of internal politics. There's no way of stopping it, so for my part, I merely avoid it.
That's strange, said Doris. Aren't you in this way denying any credibility to psychohistory?
In what way?
How can you pretend to reach a point where you can predict and guide the future when you cannot analyze and correct something as homegrown as personal frictions in the very project that promises so much?
Amaryl chuckled softly. It was unusual, for he was not a man who was given to humor and laughter. I'm sorry, Doris, but you picked on the one problem that we have solved, after a manner of speaking. Harry himself identified the equations that represented the difficulties of personal friction years ago, and I myself then added the final touch last year. I found that there were ways in which the equations could be changed so as to indicate a reduction in friction. In every such case, however, a reduction in friction here meant an increase in friction there. Never at any time was there a total decrease, or, for that matter, a total increase in the friction within a closed group, that is, one in which no old members leave and no new members come in. What I proved, with the help of Ehlers' achaotic equations, was that this was true despite any conceivable action anyone could take. Harry calls it the law of conservation of personal problems. It gave rise to the notion that social dynamics has its conservation laws as physics does, and that, in fact, it is these laws that offer us the best possible tools for solving the truly troublesome aspects of psychohistory.
Doris said, "Rather impressive. But what if you end up finding that nothing at all can be changed, that everything that is bad is conserved, and that to save the empire from destruction is merely to increase destruction of another kind?"
"Actually, some have suggested that, but I don't believe it."
"Very well. Back to reality. Is there anything in the frictional problems within the project that threaten Harry? I mean, with physical harm?"
"Harm, Harry? Of course not. How can you suggest such a thing?"
"Might there not be some who resent Harry for being too arrogant, too pushy, too self-absorbed, too eager to grab all the credit? Or, if none of these things apply, might they not resent him simply because he has run the project for so long a time?"
"I never heard anyone say such a thing about Harry." Doris seemed dissatisfied.
"I doubt that anyone would say such things in your hearing, of course. But thank you, Hugo, for being so helpful and for giving me so much of your time."
Amaryl stared after her as she left. He felt vaguely troubled, but then returned to his work and let other matters drift away.